This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, former Vice President Al Gore, likes to refer to himself as a recovering politician. He started his political career by working with his father, who was a senator from Tennessee. Al Gore was elected to the House of Representatives in 1976 and served four terms before becoming a senator. He was elected vice president in 1992. After losing the contested presidential election of 2000, he had to redefine himself and figure out a new life. Now he's one of the most influential climate change activists in the world. He shared a Nobel Prize in 2007. His interest in climate change predates his political life. One of his college mentors, Roger Revelle, was among the first scientists to warn about global warming. Gore's 2006 documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, which was basically an adaptation of his PowerPoint presentation about the effects of global warming, was a surprise box office success. Now he has a new documentary called An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Al Gore, welcome back to Fresh Air. The movie starts with you watching melting Arctic ice, forming waterfalls, like there's so much melting ice. What are we seeing and what's the significance of it?
Well, we're seeing a rapid acceleration in the melting of the land-based ice in Greenland. And it is leading to increased sea level rise around the world. The same process is underway in Antarctica, where there is much more ice still. But after making several trips to Greenland, this trip last year was quite stunning. And one of the leading scientists there said that he and his colleagues were shell-shocked by what they're watching.
You ask in the movie, where is all the water going, all this like melting ice? And you answer, some of it's going to the streets of Florida. It's coming out of the manholes and drains. Do you mean that literally or figuratively?
No, that's quite, it's literally happening. And it's happening on sunny days when the high tide comes in. I went to Miami the last time during one of the highest high tides of the year, where the sunny day flooding is most pronounced, and I literally saw fish from the ocean swimming in the streets of Miami Beach, Fort Lauderdale, and other areas up in Florida. And the same thing happens in many communities on the Atlantic coast in North America.
Yeah, you say Miami's the number one city at risk in the world. Why Miami?
Well, there are two ways to measure the cities most at risk. One is by population, and on that list, it's Calcutta and Mumbai, and actually Miami is on that list as well. But when you measure the cities at risk by assets at risk, Miami is the number one city at risk in the world, and it's because of the incredibly valuable real estate concentrated there. At a very low altitude in areas that are extremely vulnerable to sea level rise.
There have been some pretty remarkable rainstorms lately in Philadelphia, where I live. You talk about rain bombs in the movie, and I'm wondering, have I experienced rain bombs, or are they just like incredible downpours? So what is a rain bomb?
A rain bomb is a huge downpour of a kind that might have occurred once in 1,000 years in the past, but now occurs quite regularly. And the reason it happens is that more than 90% of the extra heat energy trapped by man-made global warming pollution is going into the oceans. And that accelerates the evaporation of water vapor off the oceans into the sky. And when that water vapor is transported over the land by prevailing winds and often in what the scientists now call atmospheric rivers, and they encounter storm conditions, a much larger volume of rain is released at the same time. And when it's cold enough, you get what we've heard referred to as Snowmageddon or snowpocalypse. But the shift overall is from snow to rain. The whole pattern of rainfall is shifting with a much higher concentration in these large storm events and typically a longer period of time between rainfalls during which the droughts take hold more quickly and last longer and are deeper.
You live in Tennessee. Have you been seeing direct effects of climate change where you live?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we had a rain bomb a few years ago. Thousands of my neighbors lost their homes and businesses in a huge downpour. They'd had no flood insurance because it had never in recorded history flooded in the most of the areas that were affected. It was truly a kind of apocalyptic event for those directly affected. You know, just in the last 7 years, Terry, in the U.S. alone, we've had 11 once-in-a-thousand-year events.
You know, a lot of people say that climate change can lead to war, it can lead to civil strife. And in the movie, you talk about the drought in Syria that lasted from 2006 to 2010. 60% of the farms were destroyed. Farmers were forced to move into cities. Does that figure into the civil war in Syria?
Yes, many researchers believe that it does. Now, there were other factors, of course, that were involved. The perfidy of the dictator Assad there, the proxy war fought by factions in the Middle East. But many researchers believe that the climate-related drought, the worst ever measured, the records go back 900 years there, and they know it's climate-related. A very carefully done study in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences is one of the studies that connected the dots very convincingly. And when you have the agricultural sector devastated, not only did they lose 60% of the farms, 80% of their livestock was killed. 1.5 million climate refugees were driven into the cities of Syria, where they collided with another 1.5 million refugees that had come from the Iraq war. And WikiLeaks released information, including conversations among the Syrian ministers well before the civil war there started, saying, we cannot handle this. It's beyond our capacity. There's going to be a social explosion. And indeed there was, and the gates of hell opened.
If you're just joining us, my guest is former Vice President Al Gore, and he has a new documentary about climate change, and it's called An Inconvenient Sequel. As we near the end of the movie, you're at the Paris climate meeting, and the accord was passed. That was a victorious moment for you and for many other people. The agreement actually went into effect on November 4th, 2016. 4 days later, Donald Trump was elected president. What went through your mind when he was elected? And just narrow that down at first to what went through your mind regarding climate change.
Well, I was worried, of course, that he had been supported by the large carbon polluters and had made a number of statements during his campaign that parroted the extreme climate denial that has been provoked by the carbon polluters for years. And then I decided to try to convince him to stay in the Paris Agreement. And I went to see him and began a conversation that continued even after he went into the White House. I had hoped that there was a real chance he would come to his senses, but I was wrong.
Can you tell us anything about what that meeting was like? What the main points were you wanted to make to him to show him the dangers of climate change and the reality of it?
Well, I have taken the old school view that conversations with a president should be kept confidential, but I will tell you that my simple focus was to convince him to stay in the Paris Agreement. And I had reason to believe there was a real chance that he might. And previously, before his presidential campaign, he had signed a full-page newspaper ad demanding that President Obama take a bolder action to solve the climate crisis. And so I felt there might be something to work with. And there are some people in his inner circle who certainly do believe that we have to solve the climate crisis. But he has surrounded himself with a rogues gallery of climate deniers coming out of the fossil fuel industry. And I think it's rather obvious that they've gained control of his thought process on this issue.
What's your understanding of why the president pulled the U.S. out of the accord?
I think he felt it was another way to throw a bone to his hardcore base. He's adopted the strategy of ignoring any effort to reach out to those who did not support him or to build broader coalitions across party and ideological lines, and seems to be counting on the fervor and passion of his shrinking base to keep him and his presidency afloat. And I think that a part of his base has been particularly passionate in trying to deny the existence of a climate crisis.
When I ask you about your impressions of the Trump presidency, what are your guidelines in determining how open you want to be about how you're thinking?
Well, I have no illusions about the possibility of changing Donald Trump's mind on the questions that I believe are most important. First among them, the need to solve the climate crisis. I think he has made it abundantly clear that he's throwing his lot in with the climate deniers. But one of the many problems he's posing for our country is the endless series of distractions, the new round of tweets, the new absurdities every day. When there's a new outrage, I feel as if I have to download some existing outrage onto a hard drive so I can make room for the new outrage. And the distracting quality of what he says and does is very harmful to our country's ability to sustain our focus on the most important challenges we have. And my main focus is on building a bipartisan consensus that we have to solve the climate crisis. I have no interest in access to the Trump White House. I have no interest in any further dialogue with him. I wouldn't rule it out because who knows what circumstances could develop. But I have no reservation about withholding criticism of him on those grounds. I just don't want to contribute to the constant distraction that takes us away from what we ought to be focused on.
So I had asked you earlier what your reaction was in terms of climate change when Donald Trump was elected president. What was your more general reaction when he was elected, and did you think he was going to win?
I did think there was a real chance he was going to win. I actually predicted to friends throughout much of the contest that there was a great danger that he would probably win. I lost my nerve in making that prediction the weekend before the election, when the mainstream polls had almost all of them had the race outside the margin of error going the other way, and after the FBI director had revisited his late comments about Secretary Clinton. And yet what many people saw happening did actually come to pass.
You got interested in climate change a long time ago when you were in college. You studied with Roger Revelle, who was an oceanographer and one of the first scientists to warn about climate change. What caught your attention about it? What got you so interested in it at a time when really hardly anyone was talking about it?
Well, Roger Revelle was a true giant. There's a major prize named for him that goes to a climate scientist each year. Kevin Trenberth won it this year, deservedly. Revelle was the first scientist to design the experiment that measured CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere. And when I was fortunate enough to walk into his classroom in the late 60s, he presented to our class the first 7 or 8 years of the measurements that were then starting from atop Mauna Kea on the Big Island of Hawaii. And even after 7 years, it was really obvious what was happening. The summer-winter cycle was clear, but each year the peak of CO2 rose quite significantly. And he sketched out where this was leading, what it would mean, and why we needed to be prepared to take action. And so he's the one that opened my eyes to this. And some 7 years after that, when I was elected to the House of Representatives, I immediately asked what's going on with respect to global warming. And when I found out that nothing was going on, I got permission from one of my subcommittee chairs to organize the first congressional hearing on climate change. And I invited Professor Revelle to be the leadoff witness and naively thought that his testimony would create the same epiphany for my colleagues that I had received during a full college course. And when it didn't happen, that's the first time I began to ask myself how it might be possible to communicate what he taught to a wider audience in general terms.
And that's what you're trying to do now with your films and with your, you know, with the speeches that you give, you know, around the country and around the world. I should mention you also went to Divinity School at Vanderbilt, and I think this is a program for people who are pursuing secular careers. Why did you go to Divinity College?
Well, it was an outgrowth of my decision to go to Vietnam. I opposed the war in Vietnam, but felt I should volunteer to it. My draft board was in a small town in Tennessee, and everybody knew who was eligible each month, and it just didn't feel right to come up with some fancy excuse to get out of it. But it left me torn in a way that a 21-year-old can really make such an issue quite serious. And I decided that when I came back from the Army that I would devote some serious time to investigating the questions that were really looming large for me at the time. And it was a very valuable year that I spent. I was a journalist at the same time and continued working for the then Nashville Tennessean for 5 years before I ran for Congress.
What were those questions that were looming large for you?
Well, how do you reconcile your duty as a citizen with a moral conviction that the war your country was waging was based on false premises and triggered by a lie, and in that case, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Later on, of course, the invasion of Iraq was similarly based on a lie. You know, when you're 21 years old, those kinds of questions can really take hold of you, and I wanted to really immerse myself in the ethical systems that might give me some answers. What I found were better questions.
Like what?
Well, how do you live a meaningful life?
Oh, what's the answer?
Well, be true to yourself. I mean, my faith tradition plays a role for me. I think the purpose of life is to glorify your Creator. I don't often talk this way because it sounds like I wear it on my sleeve, and I really do not. But it's a part of my grounding that helps me keep my bearings.
Well, that leads to an interesting question about politics, because religion had really entered politics in a big way. And did you ever feel like you were expected to talk a lot about your religion when you were running for office?
No, not really. Not really. I've always believed very deeply in the founders' conviction that church and state should be separated. Of course, Jefferson was the most articulate advocate of that view, and it's controversial to this day. But I think history is filled with lessons of the tragedies that result when the power to guide people's souls is intermingled with the secular power in governments. And I think that we flirt with the erosion of that line at our peril.
You became a congressman at age 28, and you were part, I think, of like the youngest presidential ticket. Bill Clinton was 45, you were 44. When you ran. When you look back now from the vantage point of being in your late 60s, do you think you were really young at the time?
Sure. I didn't feel that way then. I felt, you know, that's true for all of us, Terry.
I know. I know.
But no, I didn't feel I was really young at the time. Now, when I ran for president on my own the first time in 1988, I announced when I was 38, I did feel I was young at that time.
What made you feel like you really were young?
Well, if you look up chutzpah, as they say, you'll see a picture of me announcing at the age of 38. But I carried seven states, primaries and caucuses, and I learned a lot, and I certainly would do it again, but I was certainly young for that challenge.
You've referred to yourself as a recovering politician. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, I mean that the longer I go without a relapse, the less likely one becomes.
When you lost the 2000 election and you were out of politics, did that set off an identity crisis of who are you now? You'd been in politics most of your adult life.
No, I wouldn't say it set off an identity crisis. You might call it a professional puzzle. What the hell was I going to do? But no, I had the privilege of studying with the great Eric Erickson again back in the 60s, and he was the great psychologist of identity, and I was long past that age by then. But it did lead me to wonder what I was going to do. And I'm so happy that I found my way back to dusting off the slideshow I had been giving about the climate crisis. They were then on Kodak slides and carousels. I developed a really fancy one with three carousels in three slide projectors. And when I joined the board of Apple, Steve Jobs helped me transfer all that to the Apple keynote program, and it started evolving very rapidly then, and I've been at it ever since.
Al Gore, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Al Gore's new documentary is called An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Randy Newman's new album called Dark Matter. It's Newman's first studio album of new material since 2008. Ken says the album offers a wide variety of the styles Newman has long worked in, from the satirical to the sentimental.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to this great arena, Durham, North Carolina, the heart of the Research Triangle. We've come to this particular place tonight because we've got to look at things from every angle. We need some answers to some complicated questions if we're going to get it right. To that end, we have...
Randy Newman leads off his new album, Dark Matter, with the composition that is very nearly the reason for this album's existence. The Great Debate is almost 9 minutes long, and it's Newman's critique of faith over reason, of the hostility of discourse that has overtaken much of the country. As is true of so many Newman compositions, he assumes various roles: a narrator, a scientist, a so-called true believer. The narrator asks the scientist to explain what dark matter is, and when the scientist responds in abstract chatter, the true believer shuts him down with a gospel chorus and a ringing dismissal of Darwin's theory of evolution.
One nothing. Next one's gonna be a hard one. It's about the theory of evolution, and it's about animals also. So give me someone who knows something about evolution and animals. Who you got?
Finally, Randy Newman himself becomes a character in The Great Debate, a cynical manipulator who, his accuser says, has been setting up straw man arguments all his creative life. It's Newman's way of retroactively addressing the literal-minded critics of his work over the years, those listeners who took offense at his satire of offensive stereotypes in 1977's Short People, or who failed to hear that Newman was condemning racism when speaking in the voice of racists on his albums Good Old Boys and Sail Away.
You see, the author of this little vignette, Mr. Newman, self-described atheist and communist, creates characters like you as objects of ridicule. He doesn't believe anything he has you say, nor does he want us to believe anything you say. Makes it easy for him to knock you down, hence a straw man. I myself believe in Jesus. I believe in evolution also. I believe in global warming and in life everlasting. No one can knock me down. Oh, we can knock you down, mister. We can knock your communist friend down, too. Communist. You call me an idiot. Been knocking people like Mr. Newman down for years and years. Like this. Page 35, Georgie. Miss Dorothy, page 35. I know someone is watching me everywhere I go.
Long and languid, the great debate proceeds through its three distinct movements, beautifully orchestrated. One is left feeling nostalgic. If only we were still in such an era of polite debate. The rest of the album Dark Matter consists of fresh recordings of songs new and old. When I listened to She Chose Me, it seemed so familiar. Where had I heard this before? Then I recalled, Newman wrote it for Cop Rock, the legendary 1990 TV bomb from Hill Street Blues producer Stephen Bochco. Cop Rock had police officers busting perps and then bursting into song. It was canceled after 11 low-rated episodes, but Newman hung on to this lovely song.
I'm not much to talk to, and I know how I look. What I know about life comes out of a book. But of all of the people there are in the world, she chose me. Most of my life.
Newman does a sprightly version of another TV tune, It's a Jungle Out There, which was used as the theme song for the Tony Shalhoub detective show Monk. And this song, first released in 2016, has become even more timely. Titled Putin, it's a very funny tune ridiculing the egotism of the Russian leader.
Putin putting his pants on one leg at a time. I mean, he's just like a regular fella. He ain't nothing like a regular fella. Putin putting his hat on, hat size number 9. You saying Putin's getting big-headed? Putin says just fine. He can drive his giant tractor across the Trans-Siberian Plain. He can power a nuclear reactor with the left side of his brain. And when he take his shirt off, he drive a lady's crazy. When he take his shirt off, make me want to be a lady. It's the Putin girls.
At age 73, Randy Newman has earned the right to take the victory lap that is Dark Matter. Through the combination of his artful cult albums and his Oscar-winning mass audience soundtrack work, he's managed to have it both ways. He's at once a great cynic and a great romantic, wrapped in the American flag without any irony at all.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Randy Newman's new album, Dark Matter. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Aria Levy, was 5 months pregnant in Mongolia on assignment for The New Yorker when she had a miscarriage alone in her hotel room. At the time, she'd been married to a woman for nearly 10 years. The marriage soon dissolved, their house was sold, and the life Levy had and the future she was planning no longer existed. Her memoir is about how she went from being reluctant to have a child to being devastated when she lost her baby. It's also about being raised by a feminist mother and a father who worked with Planned Parenthood and Now. They brought her up with the free-to-be-you-and-me ethic, and Levy succeeded in challenging rules about sex and gender. But she also learned there were some things out of her control. Her memoir is called The Rules Do Not Apply. She first wrote about her miscarriage in The New Yorker. That article won a National Magazine Award in 2014. Arielle Levy, welcome back to Fresh Air. So in the book, you describe how you went from not wanting to have a baby to really wanting to have one and then feeling devastated after you miscarried. Would you describe the period when you didn't want to be a mother? What were your fears or reservations then?
You know, I think it was more ambivalence than clarity. It wasn't, oh, I don't want to. It was that I was torn about it because I thought, you know, having a child seemed like the wildest adventure there could be. But I also had grown up wanting to be a different kind of adventurer and wanting to see the world and write about it. And I knew that if I had a child, that would have to stop.
What other changes did you think you might have to make in your life? Things that you'd have to give up that you didn't necessarily want to give up?
I think that, like a lot of young people I know, I was really focused on myself, and I wanted to be the protagonist in my own life, and I wanted to do what I wanted to do. There's this great Amelia Earhart quote where she wrote in a letter to her husband, "I want to do it because I want to do it." You know, women must try to do things as men have tried. And that's how I felt. And I just thought, if you had a child, of course, that person would have to come first. And you could no longer be the kind of woman who is free to do whatever she chooses. And your path would calcify in front of you, and you'd have to put this other person first. And when I was young, that's not something I could stomach. And then, you know, as I got closer and closer to middle age, I thought, I'd love to put someone else first. I'm sick of putting myself first. I thought it might be a relief to think about someone else's needs instead of letting my life be governed by my own wishes and wanderlust.
So you had taken several foreign assignments as a journalist, and when you were pregnant, you were offered a writing assignment in Mongolia. You decided to accept the assignment. You were 5 months pregnant at the time. How did you do the calculus about whether to take that assignment or not?
Well, the first thing I did was ask my doctor, is this okay? And he said, yeah, of course it's okay. You know, I mean, a baby doesn't get dislodged by going on an airplane. You know, a fetus doesn't get dislodged by going on an airplane. That's not a thing. And, you know, so that was almost the beginning and the end of it. I mean, once a doctor said to me, of course, it's fine, I'm not superstitious and I'm not a sissy, you know? So once this doctor told me it was okay, that was that. And I think the other thing was that I love going to places where everything's new and everything's a surprise. And then writing about my experience, I mean, that's my favorite kind of story. And I knew I wouldn't be able to do another story like that for a long time. So I was delighted to have one last big, wild, adventurous story before I, and you know, temporarily stopped living that way and really committed myself to being the mother of an infant, which is all-encompassing, of course.
So soon after you got to Mongolia, you knew something was wrong. You were in a lot of pain, and you left a dinner early. You went to the dinner reluctantly. It was moved to the hotel restaurant so that you'd be nearby so that you wouldn't have to travel. You left the dinner early, went to your room, and you miscarried in your hotel room. I would like you to read the section of your book where you describe what happened. You okay with that?
Yeah. I felt an unholy storm move through my body, and after that, there is a brief lapse in my recollection. Either I blacked out from the pain, or I have blotted out the memory. And then there was another person on the floor in front of me, moving his arms and legs, alive. I heard myself say out loud, "This can't be good." But it looked good. My baby was as pretty as a seashell. He was translucent and pink and very, very small, but he was flawless. His lovely lips were opening and closing, swallowing the new world. For a length of time I cannot delineate, I sat there, awestruck, transfixed. Every finger, every toenail, the golden shadow of his eyebrows coming in, the elegance of his shoulders. All of it was miraculous, astonishing. I held him up to my face, his head and shoulders filling my hand, his legs dangling almost to my elbow. I tried to think of something maternal I could do to convey to him that I was his mother and that I had the situation completely under control. I kissed his forehead, and his skin felt like a silky frog's on my mouth.
Thank you for reading that, and that's Ariel Levy reading from her memoir, The Rules Do Not Apply. So this happens. Did you think there was a chance for the baby to survive?
You know, I wasn't in my right mind. I mean, I think at some level I knew this isn't possible. This isn't going to work out. He's just too small. There's just absolutely no way, you know. And I think because at some level I knew that, that's why I took a photograph of him. You know, when I picked up the phone eventually to call a doctor, to call for an ambulance, before I put the phone down, I took a picture of him because at some level I think I knew this isn't going to work out. And I'm going to want to look at this face again. I mean, I think that's something I see my friends do so much with their children is just gaze at them because it's amazing. I mean, they're like these beautiful, fresh humans that got made. And I think, you know, we spend so much time just gazing at them. And I knew this was it for me with this baby, that I was not going to be able to gaze at him again, and that the picture would be all that I had. So at some level, I knew it. At another level, you know, I mean, I had never given birth before, and it was also shocking. I mean, it was just so incredibly surprising that a living person had come out of me, that I wasn't really thinking straight. I mean, I remember having this thought of, like, is there a way to put him back in? I mean, I just, you know, I wasn't in my right mind.
So if you weren't in your right mind, how were you able to think clearly enough to know what to do next? You're alone in Mongolia in a hotel room. You don't really know a lot of people there. You know,
no.
You don't know the medical system. You don't have, like, your doctor in Mongolia. I mean, how did you know what to do?
Well, you know, it didn't really matter what I did. What I did do that turns out to have been, like, the totally wrong thing to do is I just thought about all the movies I'd ever seen when someone gives birth. And it's just like, okay, the first thing you do is cut the umbilical cord. And I had it in my head, I better do that immediately because otherwise he'll suffocate. I had some crazy idea about you have to block that off or it's like a fish in his gills, something. I don't know what I thought. So I yanked the umbilical cord out of myself. Which is a bad thing to do if you ever find yourself in this situation. Apparently, that's not a good thing to do. But that's what I did. And in terms of calling for a doctor, I mean, I had been in pain and had asked this one American guy that I met there if he had a doctor that he recommended. So I had this phone number on my notepad that I called.
What were the consequences of having yanked the umbilical cord?
I got lucky. There were no consequences, but you could bleed to death. I mean, you don't want to do that. And also apparently if you yank the umbilical cord off, your placenta could then not come out. Like I don't actually know the details, but you don't want to do that. It's bad to do. But it was fine for me.
So that picture you took after you miscarried, do you still have it? And how often do you look at it?
I still have it and I don't really look at it anymore. I mean, maybe once a year on the date that he was born and died, I look at it. You know, I think of the baby then, but I don't look at it anymore. When I first got back from Mongolia, I looked at it obsessively, and I tried to get other people to look at it because I just felt insane. I mean, I just felt like a switch had flipped inside of me while I was in that hotel room and I had experienced maternal love. And I couldn't get the switch to unflip when I got back, right? I just felt like a mother in the most primal part of myself. And also a switch had flipped in my body. I mean, I was lactating. I was making milk for this baby who wasn't there. So I really felt like a mother. But of course, that was invisible because I had no child. So it was sort of an identity crisis. And one of the ways I tried to resolve that was by showing anyone, you know, who I could possibly get to look at the picture. I kept trying to show them this picture and say, look, you know, like, look, I made this person. He was alive. You know, I was somebody's mother.
For a long time, you were convinced that the miscarriage was your fault, that you shouldn't have gotten on that plane to Mongolia. You shouldn't have made the trip. Even though the doctors said that it was fine to travel and that even after the miscarriage, I told you that was not the problem.
Right.
What did it take to convince you of that?
Well, I think just time. I mean, I think that having now spoken with lots of women who've had miscarriages or stillbirths or other tragedies, I want to say, because that's what it feels like when it's you, tragedies around losing their babies, I think it's pretty common to feel really guilty, to feel like you've killed your child and that you've, you know, that you made this life and failed to bring it through. It's a terrible feeling. And if you've done something that sounds bad, like flown to Mongolia, it's even easier to think, I did this. I got what I deserved, you know? But it's just not rational. I mean, that's, you know, that's not what happened. I had a placental abruption. And if you have that, which means your placenta is coming off from the uterine wall, it's not going to work out. It doesn't matter if you're in Mongolia or Massachusetts. It's just not going to work out. And eventually I just had to accept that you can't, you know, I was sort of liberated from my illusion of control by this experience and then by not being able to ever get pregnant again. I mean, I just sort of, I had to surrender to the idea that it's not up to me. It's not something I get to decide.
During this period, you lost a lot. 2 weeks after your miscarriage, your spouse ended up in rehab again for alcoholism. The relationship was falling apart. It turns out she was in way more debt than you realized. You had to sell your home because of her debt. So you lost the baby, and you basically lost your spouse during the same period and your home. So it was a period where neither the life you were planning on nor the life you had before was in place anymore. So you're very adventurous when it comes to traveling to foreign countries for writing assignments. How are you with dealing with uncertainty and with big changes in life and big changes in your identity that are kind of out of your control?
Well, I mean, that winter, I mean, that November when I got back right after Thanksgiving from Mongolia, and it felt like a tidal pull was sort of sucking all the most important pieces of my life out to sea. I mean, it just kept feeling like, what next? What am I going to lose next? What's left to lose? And, you know, at first I would wake up every day and just think, no, I don't agree to this reality. I don't accept this. I don't want my baby to be dead. I don't want my spouse to be in rehab. This is not okay. And, you know, it took a while. It took quite a while before it just sort of became a possibility for me to surrender and just think, none of this is within my control. I don't get to make these decisions. And, you know, I have to think about what do I get to keep and what I got to keep. You know, the part of my identity that was stable, the only part, because I felt like I had failed at being a wife and being a mother, I was still a writer. I still had that, and that was this thing that couldn't be taken from me, that I had been, I don't know what to say, cultivating since I was a really little kid. And I think focusing on that kind of got me through.
So the man who was your doctor in Mongolia was a South African doctor who spent a lot of time in Mongolia doing doctoring there. Dr. John Gasson is his name. And after you returned to the States, he emailed you your medical records with a very nice note. And then you kept in touch through email. Then you went to visit him, and now you're engaged, right?
Yeah. So that's what happened.
That sounds like the ending of a romance novel or like a movie.
I know, it's weird.
Where, like, tragedy leads to love. Like, one door is closed, but another door opens. Was the writer in you almost offended by this ending? Like, did you want to take
yes.
a red pencil and circle it and say, cliche? You're like, you can't write that.
That's exactly how I felt. And that's why I didn't put it in the book.
Oh, I was wondering why you didn't put it in the... I thought maybe you were afraid to jinx it.
No, it's too trashy. It's too... And also, you know, I mean... I think that because romantic love, you know, heterosexual romantic love is like such a thing. I mean, it's just such the heart of all these stories we grow up on. I don't think it would be reasonable as a writer to put at the end of a book like this, and then we fell in love, you know, then this. And also, it's like he's also sort of a cliched hero for that kind of thing because he's like rides horses and is a doctor in Mongolia and, you know, can build a house with his hands, all that kind
of
stuff.
I see the cover of the romance novel. You know?
Right, exactly.
With you riding a horse on the beach.
And that is actually what happens a lot now, is that he did teach me to ride horses on the beach. I mean, so it's also ridiculous that I didn't put it, because I think that if you put at the end of a book like this, and then we fell in love, it's unreasonable to ask the reader not to think what you're saying is, and then Prince Charming came and saved me, and we lived happily ever after, and that saved me from my grief. So I didn't put it because that's not accurate. It didn't, you know, falling in love with him didn't save me from the grief of losing my son. It didn't end the grief of my last marriage ending. It didn't do anything except begin a new chapter. And I just didn't think it was appropriate to put it in this book. That's not what this book was about. So it's not there.
Well, Ariel Levy, thank you so much for talking with us. And thank you for writing your book.
Thank you so much for having me. Your show is my very favorite.
Oh, gosh. Thank you so much. Ariel Levy is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the memoir, The Rules Do Not Apply.